This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Welcome to Psych Tech, the psychology and technology podcast where we explore the human side of technology. I am Kelly Dunlap.
And I'm Josue Cardona.
So there's been some interesting stuff going around on the interwebs, and I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, the election, which is obviously a big deal, Pokemon Go, which has obviously been a big deal. Something a little bit nerdier that you and I have both been pretty interested in, and it has to do with our brains.
Yeah, that thing that we don't know as much about as we think we do.
No, it's about 3 pounds and about the size of a head of lettuce.
What does it do? How does it work?
We have no
Nobody
idea.
Knows.
Exactly. Well, it's getting better. In the last, I want to say the last 2 or 3 weeks, there's been, I think explosion is probably too strong a word, because there's been about 3 or 4 articles that have come out, but that's a lot for neuroscience that has specifically been looking at advances in neuroscience and just understanding the brain at any kind of level at all. And so today on the podcast, we really want to talk about what these articles have said, what they've found, and maybe what that means for us as people, as humans, as clinicians, as human beings.
Yeah, I mean, and the crazy thing is that the technology is, you know, it continues to get better, and as it's getting better, then we get higher quality imaging, and we get, we're always talking about getting more and more data, more and more information, and kind of making sense of that. And specifically the new mapping of the 360 parcels, right? This completely new map of the brain is super exciting. It's like finding uncharted territory on the world, or kind of if we redrew our maps. I don't know if we were still using the maps that we had 200 years ago, and you know the countries aren't laid out the same way anymore. And it's like if we had never updated our maps, and now suddenly we have a new version, mm-hmm. and it was published in Nature, and you know it's a pretty big deal. You know, the world of neuroscience is super exciting to me, and I don't know, like how do you view it? Am I exaggerating a little? Like what is this like for you?
Well, let me tell you a story. So many years ago, so probably about five years ago, I was a student in my doctoral program, and I was at the pretrial services agency, which is, you know, people get arrested, but they obviously have some kind of mental health need. And so they came to us instead of a quote unquote normal judge or normal court. You know, it was mental health court, basically. And my supervisor at the time was talking about this guy named Amen, A-M-E-N, who was the forefront of neuropsychology at the time, especially related to ADHD. And I can distinctly remember Dr. Klein, my supervisor, saying over and over again, just watch out for this stuff. You know, neuroscience is the future, which, you know, when you're getting a doctorate in clinical psychology, you don't really want to hear that, that your profession is not the future of its own profession. but it is very, very exciting to see how much has changed, how much we've learned. And, you know, especially recently, as you mentioned, that the imaging is just getting better and better, and we're able to get so many different ways of looking at the brain.
So it's interesting you bring up Dr. Amen. I didn't have that in my notes at all, but he's based out of Atlanta, and he has this great book on ADHD where I think it's called The 7 Types of ADHD. And if you look at the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, you know, ADHD is one thing, and it has a few different variables, but it is one diagnosis. And because he's been using fMRI, he splits it up into 6 or 7 different categories, because the brain activity is so different in these When he, you know, there's the observable behavior, and then he's using these fMRIs to match them up, and he's saying, look, this, yeah, we can, they all fall under ADHD, but look at how different the brain activity is in these different groupings. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and that's something that the, you know, the, where psychology is now, or psychiatry, the DSM does not take that into consideration. And he's actually kind of a controversial figure because of that, because he's going that extra step further and using this technology. It's been around for a while. fMRI is not new. And he's painting this completely different picture of what ADHD is and other things and other disorders as well. But it's fascinating. I mean, he's got this, it's a huge book, but it's really cool.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think my professor is right. I think you're right. It's exciting. It's the future. And he is a little bit of a controversial figure because of that. Specifically, fMRIs measure the blood flow to the brain. And so you are making the assumption that blood flow equals activation. So it presumes that blood flow is equivalent to working and functionality. And I mean, there's so many different ways of looking at the brain, you know, the fMRI, you know, blood flow, the MRI, which is structure, the EEG, which is electrical activity. There's so many different ways of looking at the brain. And of course, what the brain looks like changes based on what you're looking at. Are you looking at structure? Are you looking at blood flow, electrical impulses, connectivity? And there's so much that we don't know, but here's some quick brain facts, stuff that we think we know about the human brain. So, for example, one thing that was actually on my comprehensive exam, so this is why I know this, is that there's about 100 billion neurons in the brain. So, of course, neurons being the cell bodies. And that about 60% of the human brain is comprised of fat. So good job, brain. Way to be fat and lazy. Which we don't. I mean, we've talked about the brain being lazy before. Let's see other cool stuff. Again, we mentioned it's about 2 pounds, about the size of a cabbage, and yeah, it's a very complex organ in the brain that demands a lot of attention and resources. And you know, somebody has said, and I've heard this quote so many times, I don't know whether it's true or not, but as prolific as it is, it's probably not true. But the idea that we know more about our universe than we do about the human brain. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, I could argue either way, but I'll take it. We don't know. I think it probably, there are lots of mysteries in the universe in general, right? In space. It's lots of things we haven't discovered, but we're looking at the brain and we don't know how it works. We don't know why things are happening.
No, and just like a quick trip down neuroscience lane, I guess, historically speaking, obviously, you know, we've been trying to understand the brain and how it works for a very, very long time. But yeah. Until recently, in like the past, you know, at least until the microscope was invented, so the past couple hundred years, the only way we could really figure out anything about the brain was to have something go wrong with it, or for there to be some kind of horrible accident, or for us to poke around inside living and dead brains. So one of the more gruesome aspects of psychology's past was trepanation, which is when you would drill holes in somebody's skull to look at the brain and examine the brain and sometimes remove pieces of the brain. There's also the Egyptians took the brains out through the noses and cracking open cadavers to look at the brain and how it works and what things like that. All very.
Oh, what's the thing you put through the eye? I forget what that's called.
Through the eye, I don't know, and I'm kind of glad I don't.
It looks like a it's like a big stake, like a giant nail, and you kind of put it through the eye. No,
I don't know.
I don't remember either, but yeah, but these were all like, this is how you cure brain stuff.
Yeah.
You know, just drill a hole and relieve pressure.
Yeah, that was the idea. And whether it's in the cranium or through the eye or through some other place, like the idea of just releasing the pressure, kind of like when they would bloodlet, you know, get rid of the bad humors or whatever. And, you know, that's kind of where the story of Frankenstein comes from, is the idea of examining the human body, specifically the brain and how it functions in really kind of gruesome and archaic ways. And I wish I could say it was, you know, a long, long time ago, but it really wasn't. Basing our understanding, our scientific understanding off of some really, really weird and gross ways of looking at the world. And even today, I mean, some of the procedures just seem so slapstick and haphazard. So for example, for people who have really, really bad seizures, one of the treatments is to go inside the brain. So like take off, well, I don't think you have to take off the skull, but you have to drill into the skull and then you sever the corpus callosum. It's this tight bundle of nerves that connects the two hemispheres together. And that way you can't have a grand mal seizure, so to speak, or like a really big seizure because the brain can't communicate back and forth or as effectively back and forth between the hemispheres because the corpus callosum has been cut. I mean, that sounds like some medieval stuff. So I'm trying to think if there's anything out there. I mean, electroshock therapy was really popular and then it was really not popular. And now I'm kind of seeing it come back. I think they call it electric stimulation therapy now instead of electric shock therapy, which I guess they're just rebranding it. The idea of just pumping electricity into the brain to kind of jumpstart it like you would a dead or dying battery. And so there's just all these ways that we've tried to work with the brain before. Oh, I can't believe I almost forgot. I almost forgot our buddy Phineas Gage.
Yeah.
I mean, Phineas Gage, he's kind of famous in the psychology world. He's kind of a big deal. And so I believe it was the 1800s. He was working on a railroad spike or a railroad spur, and an explosion caused a railroad spike to drive up from beneath his chin and up into the front of his brain. So obviously there was some brain damage. He didn't die, though, which was amazing. But what was documented is that his personality completely changed. He went from this very chill, loving, affectionate guy to somebody who was aggressive and mean and just a big 180 in his personality type. And, you know, looking back, the portion of his brain that was damaged and that they looked at after he had passed away, a scientist had, and we now think of that as the prefrontal cortex and kind of the seat of personality and reason. And the only way we kind of had any idea before is because some guy got a railroad spike blown into his brain.
And I mean, some of it almost sounds, I mean, it always sounds like a story that's like not, how could this possibly be?
Like a myth.
Because, yeah.
Psychology, yeah, urban legends. That's our next podcast.
Yeah, because the story is like that thing just like went through and then I don't think he even passed out or anything, right? I mean, it was one of those things. I don't know. I think I've heard different versions of or read different versions of the story. But I know over time he was able to recover some functions and stuff. But, you know, the guy didn't die.
Right.
Yeah. The brain. Go brain.
So, you know, again, up until 4 or 5 years ago, what the brain and its functioning really, really limited in what we could do. Obviously, again, the fMRI, the MRI, the EEG, EKGs, things like that. We know there's a lot going on, but we've never really been able to decide on something even as specific as the number of areas. Like, how many areas of the brain are there? You know, we don't really know. Or for anybody who's ever had an interest in brain surgery, the fact that they will open up the skull and use electrodes to poke different parts of the brain, and you have to be conscious as the patient because they'll ask you a question to see whether or not they're in the right part of the brain. It's kind of like sticking your finger into an electrical socket to see if it's on or not.
Yeah, now hit the breaker. Yep, I felt it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, but that's what's so exciting about the research that came out in the last couple of weeks is it's all been about imaging. And I think the most exciting and forward-thinking article was specifically about a group of researchers who have taken hundreds and hundreds of brain scans. So fMRI, MRI, EEGs, all the different ways of looking at the brain. And they were able to collapse them into one another. And again, I'll try to describe it as best I can. You should really check out the article. And they came up with, I think they said 130 new quote unquote divisions of the brain. So basically they rewrote the map. They took the current map of the brain and wasn't completely overwritten, but a large part of it had been reconfigured based on all these different ways of measuring the brain and looking at the brain and then how they all compile to one another.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think I wonder if we're painting a good picture, you know, on audio, because it really is a three-dimensional figure, right? I mean, imagine that cabbage, and then it's not just on the outside. Each of those maps, there's a depth to it, and behind that, there's something else, and behind that, there's something else. And the only way you see that is by simultaneously measuring all these different areas and then seeing where they match up and how they match up across different brains. So if you and I are speaking at the same time that we're speaking, there should be different parts of our brain that kind of, you know, we like to say light up, but that means that an EEG would be measuring the electrical current going through certain parts of the brain. The fMRI would be measuring blood flow to that part of the brain. And then you match all those three things together. And then it's like, oh, look, that area right there has all of these things going on at the same time while that person is doing X activity, which in this case might be language, right? Or speaking out loud. And then you can tie that to that behavior and then kind of draw a circle around it and say that that's a new area. And that's like a very simple way of explaining what they've been doing at the... It's called the Human Connectome Project. I believe it's an NIH-funded project. University of Washington, University of Minnesota involved there. There's a few different people. And so the Human Connectome Project would be where you could find out kind of what they're doing. And that was published in Nature, this particular one. But it's hard to understand because even though we say mapping, it is a 3D object.
Yeah, I mean, mapping in three dimensions... I think the best analog, and this is one that they use in a different article, and they showed it off at South by Southwest, is they were able to create a virtual reality simulation of the brain and where you could basically walk through the brain in three dimensions. And that's really the only way to conceptualize it, at least accurately, is because there's so much going on. There's so many layers, like an onion, you know, like Shrek's onion. It just... And there's a reason why we don't understand a lot about the brain. It's because it's innately complex, and getting your brain to wrap around your brain in the 3D image is not only meta, but a real challenge. And then to not only then take that to the next level of making it accessible to non-neuroscientists is incredibly difficult. And one thing I noticed throughout all of the articles that we pulled for this week's podcast, the brain is represented beautifully. So, for example, almost all the pictures reminded me of stained glass, like this very mm-hmm. beautiful visual interpretation of what's going on in the brain. Because I don't know if anybody's seen a real human brain. It's ugly. It is really, really ugly.
And gray. It is not colorful.
Nope. It's gray, and there's some white stuff, and mm-hmm. it's wrinkly, and it's a gross looking organ, like most of our organs. But these representations of it are beautiful, and it reminds me a lot of, you know, like save the animal campaigns. It's a lot easier to save the animal when it's a cute, cuddly, attractive looking thing. It's easier to save a koala than like a salamander. So I think that's a large part of what scientists are getting at now, which I do see as a hopeful progression, is that it's not enough to find the science and do the science, but then you have to convey it in a way so that people care about it. I mean, I've studied neuroscience. It's part of my comprehensive exams. I have books, more books than I ever want, about this kind of thing, and I still don't even think that I grasp a tenth of it. So somebody who just knows the brain is the thing inside their head between their ears, it's really hard to get excited in terms of funding, in terms of consumption, in terms of modifying behavior when you really don't understand anything that's coming at you. So I think they've done a good job with that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's because, like I said, we're excited. We're nerding out about this squishy mess between our heads, right? And but it's super exciting because there's so much going on, and I love especially the glass brain, right? The that which is the brain that you mentioned, which they use in VR. And I definitely want to go into, like, I want to make some predictions about that. But it is beautiful, and to see that, and to, you know, just it's smart visualization, right? Anybody who sees that would be like, whoa, I want one of those for my house. What is it? Oh, it's a brain. Really? But everything that you just said about, you know, everything you've read and what you've covered, I wrote down in my notes, how much of this do you feel is, like, how much of what you learned has become obsolete? Because I feel like, you know, I mean, we're old enough where Pluto was and wasn't a planet. Dinosaurs had and didn't have feathers.
Right.
And I'm a native Spanish speaker. And over the course of my life, the alphabet has changed. And some of the rules for writing have changed in such a way where I know, you know, there are things where I'm not sure what the rule is anymore and what's right. And it's a weird feeling. And so in terms of the brain, like, how do you feel? Like, do you have to throw out some of those books? Probably.
Probably. But I think that's the same with any scientific field, though, is that anything you think you know, there's a reason that, you know, in order to stay licensed or to stay relevant, you by law have to attend certain educational requirements. You need to keep up on the literature, because any kind of scientific study is going to have that kind of progression. I mean, that said, on the plus side, because of mine was a clinical program and not a specifically a neuroscience program, what we learned, I don't want to say it is basic, but it's, you know, if I was to talk to a neuroscientist, it would definitely be basic. I mean, there's stuff like, these are the lobes of the brain. And I think that's still pretty, you know, pretty solid statement there. Or vision is processed in the occipital lobe. I still feel pretty confident in my ability to say that. So I'm sure there's turnover, just like you would in any scientific field. But it does feel like the faster that technology is advancing, the more we're learning, the faster we're learning it, the harder it is to keep up.
Yeah, because even in this article, like any good research article, it says, you know, this is a start. This is, now we want other people to kind of look at this and say, what, you know, compare it to what they've seen. And there will be, this is going to happen again. We're going to keep remapping, and we're going to find more and more areas. And the finer the detail of the readings that we can make, the more that's going to be mapped. And this is, again, I'm going to put links to kind of to videos and pictures of this stuff, because it's really impressive, but it's still a visualization that you can present to anybody and easily understandable. Again, like stained glass, all that stuff. But if you go deeper, right, and you start going into those billions of neurons, things get really, really difficult, let's say. So there's a game called iWire that it's a game in quotes, and it's designed as a 3D puzzler. It's taking actual what you're doing is you have these scans and you're mapping individual neurons. Now, because of how small they are, the way the game is set up is it's split up into these 3D cubes, and then you're looking at the scans and trying to identify how they're connected to one another. It's a crowdsourcing of data that's been going on for a few years. And once you start looking at that level of detail, not only in the scans, but actually in the models that are being created, you know, once we get to that detail, we'll be, right now, you know, 360 sections is like one way of looking at it. Once you go deeper and deeper and deeper, we'll be able to, it's going to be incredible, but it's also, it's actually overwhelming to think about how specific, like just how much is going on in the brain. Let's just put it that way. There's just so much. I mean, neurons in general, right? I mean, they're super small and they make everything happen, but it's really, really impressive.
Yeah, and I'm actually doing a quick scientific search right now, because when you're talking about just the complexity of it, it made me think, well, I know we coded the human genome. How many pieces of information were in that? I don't know off the top of my head, so I'm doing on-the-fly research.
Well, it's funny because the human genome, these are proteins that are mapped out, right? And then it's a recipe, right? It's not something that is constantly changing.
Right.
Once we map the genome and we map the genome of other creatures, then we can see what the outliers are, where the mutations are, and then we can connect that to different medical disorders and conditions. But it's not changing, right? It's set. That's why we can see our biome, our genome, and it's like, oh, that's human. This is this, right? That's why the brain is constantly doing stuff. It may be doing things that we don't know it's doing yet. And what we can measure, again, like that explanation at the beginning when you're like, you know, this is, there's blood flow, there's electrical activity, there's all sorts of things going on at once. Not to mention how it's forming and reforming itself over time. And it's just, it's a lot. It's a moving target. It's always a moving target.
Right.
Never stand still.
So just for reference, the best estimate now is that 20 to 25,000 protein coding genes. So when you're coding the human genome, you've got all these proteins that are these genome coded proteins, and they're arranged in certain ways, but they tend to be consistent. And if there's variation, it's indicative of disease. But again, compare that to 100 billion neurons that even in healthy individuals are not the same, because the brain is what we refer to as plastic, meaning that it's something that is constantly changing. As Josue mentioned, it's something that can rebuild, and it is different person to person. That's why when you go in to have brain surgery, they have to poke different parts of the brain. Even if they know they're in the right place, everybody's brain composition is different. I mean, think about something as simple as left versus right-handedness. You know, that's going to influence the strength and the power of your motor cortex on a specific side of the brain. I know people like to talk about being right-brained or left-brained. You know, are you logical or are you artistic? And, you know, there definitely is some merit to that too, but it's going to vary from person to person. And again, these are in completely healthy, quote-unquote, specimens. Whereas, you know, once you start throwing in any kind of abnormality, it gets even more difficult. So yeah, it's like it's a moving target in space and all in the entire universe. We're trying to pin it down, and it's not impossible, because nothing is impossible with the human spirit, but it's really, really challenging. And that's why these maps are so important, is not so much in that they are the answer to what ails us, but it at least gives us something to work from. I think that's what you mentioned earlier, that the author said this is a foundation, this is a basis. You know, we don't really know, we can't map everything, we can't map 100 billion neurons for every individual, but at least it can get us in the ballpark, and at least that ballpark somewhat resembles what it's supposed to, as opposed to, you know, cracking somebody's head open to release the pressure to help them out.
and we'll get to the point where we can, in very, very short time, map every single neuron in your brain at a certain moment, right? But that doesn't even matter as much, because what really matters is how the electricity is moving from neuron to neuron at any given moment. So even when the technology gets to a point where we can map that thing to the finest detail possible, and let's just for the sake of argument assume that a neuron's a neuron, that it's the electrical signals that then are going to really then answer the questions, right? If we compare it to something from a year ago, it's like, oh, well, you're having trouble, I don't know, remembering stuff, right? So let's say somebody who's early onset Alzheimer's or something like that, and then you're looking at where the neurons aren't allowing that connection to pass through, and then you can map the movement of, so it's like traffic patterns on a Google map, right? And then that is something completely different. So we're still mapping, we're still making the Google map essentially, and then adding very basic traffic patterns over it, because the truth is, if you look at a Google map, those have gotten more complex over time. Right now, when you turn on your app, there's transit, there's cars, there's buses and trains, there's bicycle routes, and that doesn't even consider the fact that you can walk across from any point to any other point, and that there's also three dimensions, right? So there's height and depth. So we're probably a little further than mapping just the surface on a Google map, but we're adding satellite imaging. I don't know if my analogy holds up at this point. I think I've taken it too far.
or just far enough. We'll go just far enough. So the brain's not just electrical. There's a large component of the brain that's chemical. For example, I'll take depression. If we're talking about the chemical components of depression in the human brain. So without revisiting my neurophysiology too much, and hopefully I'm still close enough. So basically what happens is that at the end of a neuron, there is we'll call it a synapse. I know that's not the specifically technical term. The terminal button is the right term, but we'll call it the synapse. The space between where one neuron ends and the other one begins. It's like a puzzle piece, but they don't fit together 100%. There's a space between them, between one neuron and the other. And what traverses that synapse can be electrical signals, but also chemicals that are released via those electrical signals. In depression, so you'll have these chemicals that are released from one neuron, and they flow into the synapse, into this open space. And they are then absorbed, in theory, if all's going well, absorbed by the other end of the cell at the other end of the synapse. So the interlocking puzzle piece side of it. What happens in depression is that sometimes there can be either too much or too little of a specific neurochemical. So dopamine is one people are pretty familiar with. So let's imagine that we're a neuron. We're a happy little neuron. We're pretty. We look like a star. We're shiny. We have lots of tendrils everywhere. An action potential, which is the electricity is going down one part of the neuron and it's getting ready to fire. And it's saying, hey, we need to release dopamine right now. And so at the end, at the terminal button, the dopamine is released into the synapse. And the adjacent neuron, it's like, ooh, yeah, thank you, picks it up and takes it. It's like a handoff, like a dead drop for a spy. You know, you're dropping something off and somebody else is picking it up. In depression, it's often that there's either too much or too little dopamine that is either being released or being taken. So, I mean, think about that for just a second. It could be too much being released. It could be too much taking in. It could be not enough released, and it could be not enough being taken in. So just in this one tiny incident, there's already four different ways that the chemical is interacting with your brain that could contribute to depression. And then keep in mind that dopamine is not the only chemical that can contribute to depression. You could have serotonin. You could have norepinephrine in addition to dopamine issues as well. So even for this one tiny, tiny example, there's so many different ways that people can react, or the ways that our bodies process the information. And that's why one medication will work for somebody with depression and maybe one medication won't. Because if you have a dopamine-based medication, but your deficiencies in serotonin, then it's going to have no effect or very little effect. So I guess all that to say that it's beyond the electrical. You layer in the chemical as well, and the uniqueness of every individual and the plasticity of the brain, it makes my head hurt. Like I don't know about you, but I feel like I have a headache now and I need to go lay down.
and it's everything that you're saying is so important, and we don't know the answers to how these things work with each other. And then on an individual basis, when you go to your general, your primary care doctor, and you say, I'm feeling depressed, they're not thinking about everything that Kelly just said, right? Everything you just said.
Yeah, nobody does.
Right?
It's okay.
They're like, yeah, yeah. And the general knowledge about these things doesn't go to that level. And unfortunately, because there's so many gaps in the understanding, that the pharmaceutical industry is also not you know, as informed as it will be someday. But right now, you know, different medication just works for different people, and we just try it out to see kind of what happens. But what's happening is that mess that you explained, you know, and there's so much going on. And that's why this is exciting, because we're trying to find those answers. The only way to find those answers is to go deeper and really, really observe what's happening. And I think that especially the VR implementation of the glass brain is probably the most exciting, when you imagine having that explanation, but giving it to somebody while they are in a walking around or exploring their own brain, mm-hmm. where I want to think that it would make a lot more sense, you know, where you could tell someone do this and then you see what's happening inside the brain to a certain extent, and then imagine going deeper and deeper and you know, finer and finer detail, to really be able to see some of those things. You know, we'll still be doing a lot of modeling, but at least there we can get much closer to a live version of your brain. Because, you know, you can see an EEG, you put it on, you see what's going on. But then to have that level of just going around in a 3D space, which is your brain, and seeing it. And then, again, the glass brain is just beautiful. But I think about how, you know, the educational implications of being able to walk through your own brain as you're using it is so exciting, so exciting. And you start putting these different things together, right? So something like that game iWire, you start the advent of virtual reality, which means that, you know, an EEG, there are cheap EEGs. They're very simple ones that are kind of like a headband and only have a few contacts. You couple that with an Oculus Rift or an HTC Vive at somebody's house, and now you have a very simple way to kind of to really teach people about their brain in a way that you couldn't do before. And it's consumer facing. It would still cost about $1,000, maybe a little more, but you may have half of those devices already at your house. And that is just so exciting for me. I can't, and it doesn't feel that far off. It's actually probably just missing the software. The software may exist, and I just don't, I'm not familiar with a consumer-facing version of it, but I'm sure there's already enough ways to do it at your house.
I mean, I also understand this is very, very niche, and that not everybody would want a fully accurate physiological representation of their brain. Although I think it would be awesome, and I would love to play around with it. I keep having this this visualization in my mind of how awesome it would be to have like a children's museum where, you know, everything's all hands-on and you can walk through the human heart, but instead there's a giant brain and you get to pick up a calcium or potassium or some other chemical and run it through the brain, and the brain reacts based on what chemical you're carrying and where you're carrying it to. And, you know, if you're dressed up as a dopamine, you can only go certain places because dopamine only goes certain places in the brain. And, you know, the corpus callosum would be this giant bridge. That to me would be the coolest thing ever. And obviously I don't think it's going to happen physically. So a virtual reality space where I could do that would be amazing. I would love to see that. The teaching potential, or even just, I mean, can you, this is future casting here, but can you imagine if you were feeling not right, whether you're having difficulty with concentration or you're feeling depressed or you can't focus or remember a lot of things that you've experienced while you're pregnant, oddly enough, and you could just go to the doctor and they would put, you know, something on your forehead, maybe a magic little hat with a couple of diodes, and then they would be able to navigate their way through your brain and figure out, you know, what is working, what is not. And especially if you had some kind of pre-existing map. So, you know, if you went in when you were healthy and they took a brain scan and then you came back 60 years later because you feel like you're developing Alzheimer's, and they're able to compare that reading with the one from when you were 20, I think that to me, that's so exciting and it's so amazing because you're getting a baseline, and then you really would be able to kind of tell, you know, what on an individual level, you know, what is going on with this person, what's working, what's not working. And I'm assuming by the time we get to that point, we'll be able to address the issue. Because that's another thing right now is that even if we know that there's a problem, we don't necessarily know how to fix it. You know, like I mentioned,
like Alzheimer's,
or like I mentioned with epilepsy earlier, we know what's going on and we know what's happening. We just don't know how to stop it. So in severe cases, we just chop into the brain.
Yeah. Imagine you go online and you're not feeling okay. You go into that simulation and then you invite, you know, you kind of crowdsource the whole thing. And now you have 50 people all looking through to see if they can see anything that's weird or doesn't match up. And it becomes a social experience, and you're just there to help people out because this glass brain simulation is gorgeous, and you kind of enjoy moving around, exploring the human brain. And again, I think we're pretty close to that. Again, not the level of detail we would need to kind of solve the problem necessarily, right? Like you were saying. But at least I think that right now is the time to start doing experiments like that, because this is the year of VR. And for the next, these are the next couple years of VR, where it's starting to come into more and more homes. And there's this desire for novelty and there's this curiosity. So you see a lot of things coming out that are VR experiences and they're very short and people just want to try out different stuff. So imagine, you know, you go online and or it comes in the box, right? It's just, oh, here are, you know, 30 different experiences you can have. And one of them is walking through a brain. And there's that little note that says, well, if you buy this basic EEG, you could, you know, watch the mapping, the activity in your own brain. And if we take advantage of this time now that people just want are just want whatever they can do in VR, man, we could get a lot of brain explorers being developed right now. It's prime time for this.
Yeah, it's the brain, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the brain ship psych tech, whose continuing mission is to seek out new neurons and new neural connections to boldly go where no one has gone before.
Actually, that's a whole, you do it like a ship and you're moving through.
Like the magic school bus. The magic school bus did that inside the body, but just do that inside the brain with virtual reality. Miss Frizzle and everything, I'm there.
All right, so when we finish this recording, we're going to sit down, write a proposal, try to get funding for some of this stuff.
Yes.
Because I'm excited.
Yeah. Dear people who give money, we are not neuroscientists, but we want to create a tiny starship that flies for the brain. Because I've heard crazier scientific things that have gotten, you know, gotten funded. So I think that's a yes.
You know, there was a ride. I think it was called Body Tours, I think. That's kind of what it was. It was, I may be mixing up my names, like Star Tours with something else, but it was very much like, oh, what's the Martin Short, Dennis Quaid movie? Inner Space. Do you remember Inner Space?
Nope.
Okay. So Inner Space is this movie where they, Dennis Quaid goes into a machine. It gets, they shrink the machine and it's like a shuttle, and then they inject it into Martin Short, and he is traveling through his body. And then they made a ride at, I don't remember if it was Disney or if it was another theme park. And then you had a tour through the human body. And it was one of those simulations where everybody's in a shuttle and it's moving. Mm-hmm. And you've got the screen up front. So I don't think a version, the brain version of that would be too different, except that we could do it in VR and have all these different experiences. Because again, just the fact that we understand it enough now to move around through it or follow the activity, I think it's exciting. Ultimately, we keep talking about observable behaviors and things like that, but I think there's, the more we do this kind of thing, we're going to get to a point where things are going to start clicking, you know, and we'll start being able to get a lot of aha moments when we see this happening and this other thing happening and putting them together. And that only happens if more people are excited about the brain.
So more data. That's what I'm hearing. More data.
Different, I think, more interesting ways to engage the data.
Give your brain to science. We'll give you a cookie.
Yeah.
I'd be down with that. But yeah, I think that's probably going to be it for this episode. But Josue, was there anything else that you wanted to throw in there?
Let me see. No. We covered everything.
Okay, cool. Cool. So hopefully this was stimulating for your thinky bits, for the squishy parts between your ears. If you have a headache, that's okay. It happens. Don't worry about it. Just go drink some water. You'll be fine. And I won't explain what a headache is, because it doesn't actually have to do with the brain, because your brain actually cannot feel pain. So that's a fun fact, too, that if you were to stab somebody in the brain, they wouldn't feel it. They'd probably die. But
like that, before like that, the first scene in Hannibal. Have you seen that?
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, the brain has no pain receptors. So yeah. A headache is actually the blood vessels in your skin. Anyway, doesn't matter. Yeah. That's it for this episode of Psych Tech. Thank you for sticking with us on our neuroscience geek out-a-thon. And make sure that you tune in every other week for Psych Tech. As we mentioned on the feed earlier, we're going every other week because we have a brand new show called Headshots, which will be in the other every other week slot, which is specifically about gaming and mental health, since we're trying to keep Psych Tech, and otherwise it would have devolved into Headshots. Anyway, so thank you all for subscribing and listening in here. Be sure to check out and subscribe to Headshots as well. And you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on TuneIn, and MySpace, and Dogpile, and LinkedIn, and all the other places that you find people to do things.
Not Dogpile, but everything else, yes.
Darn it. All right, thanks everybody. We'll catch you next time.